Turn tonight, please, to Revelation chapter number 5. Revelation chapter number 5. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, again, I pray for your help for us, for we will not fully understand nor fully appreciate what is happening in the text unless you reveal it to us. And it is our prayer that we grasp the fullest possible meaning from these your words. And so help us, please. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. So last Wednesday we looked at chapter 4, just for the sake of getting us oriented and review the entire focus shifts, whether it is literal, and by that I mean an actual bodily experience of being taken to heaven, or whether it is a visionary experience of being taken to heaven, we do not know. But we do know that John is at least mentally, emotionally transported from earth to heaven in Revelation chapter 4. And we talked a little bit about the technicalities of that, the way it relates to the structure of the book and the outline of the book. And it would be my understanding, and certainly the way that I will present it, that what in John 1 was given to us, write the things that you have seen, the things that are, and the things that will be hereafter. The hereafter is on the threshold of being revealed in chapters 4 and 5. The first thing that John saw in Revelation chapter 4 was, interestingly enough, a throne. And the chapter is oriented really around the throne. And certainly God the Father is sitting on the throne. And the angels are not worshiping the throne, nor are the elders worshiping the throne. They are worshiping the one on the throne. And I think that we would understand that the throne is at the very least indicative or symbolic of the power and the right to rule. That what is happening here, folks, and this has always been, in a sense, happening. It's always been happening, but now the rule of God that has always existed is about to be manifested on the earth. And we will get to that, not tonight, but we will get to that at a later time, that there is a dimension of visibility in the last part of the book of Revelation that doesn't exist in the norm. So tonight, then, our attention turns to chapter number 5. And structurally, there's no real break between Revelation 4 and 5. We've divided them up for the sake of time. But, right, I mean, you know, we have the account of the throne and the one sitting on the throne and the beauty of the one and the majesty of the one on the throne and the way the one on the throne is recognized both by angelic beings and most likely representative of humanity, human beings, worshiping human beings. And there is this great scene of worship. And again, John does not lose his train of thought or really even change directions. In chapter 5, verse number 1, he introduces us to yet another dimension of information. But at that point in time, there is a clear change in where he goes with that. So verse number 1, I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the backside, sealed with 7 seals. So he sees the one sitting on the throne, and he sees in the hand of the one on the throne this book. And if you're using a version other than the King James, it might say scroll. Or you might have a note in your study Bible that it would be a scroll or a book. It is, if you care, a biblion, a Bible, a book. That's what the word means. It's a book. A biblion, a bibliography, a written document. So it might be a book, and it might be a scroll, and it is sealed with seven seals, and there is writing within, and on the backside it is filled. And this book, Revelation 5:1, is in the hand, the right hand of the one who is sitting on the throne. So again, we have this very clear imagery of this gloriously majestic deity sitting on his throne, and he is holding in his right hand a book. It is a sealed book. And we know from the outset that there are seven seals. And it has much writing. It is written within, and it is written on the backside. And as you might imagine, if you think about it, there is a tremendous amount of speculation about the contents of the book. There are, in fact, no fewer than six what are considered major views on the contents. I don't really want to even go down the pathway of wading through those six views and deciphering them. Apart from this, a couple of things. One of those views is the view that teaches that the contents of the book are Israel's divorce decree. That this is where God's bill of divorcement from Israel is contained, that frees him from his covenant with Israel so that he might be wed to the church. It seems to me that to have a lengthy debate about what's in the book is an exercise in futility on the one hand and completely unnecessary on the other hand. Do not the contents of the book get revealed to us when the seals are broken? Now, I mean, I would admit to being a simpleton about this, but I've got in chapter 5 this information, there's a book with seven seals, and I've got in Revelation 6 the loosing of the seals, or the beginning of the loosing of the seals. And it is absolutely, utterly lost on me how anybody could seriously think that the book contains anything other than the authority and the declaration and the contents of those events. Now, that's just me. So if you said, what do you think is in the book? I think that we're told what's in the book. I think when the seals are broken, the contents of the book become open to everybody so that we don't need to speculate on what the book says. The book says, this is what's happening. But again, that's just me. And you should know, if you like to pursue these things and study them privately, that you can find, again, no fewer than six major views on the contents of the book. So, right, the book is in God's right hand. It is clearly His book. It is invested with His authority. And it seems to me that it contains what He is about to do, and that it probably is the fulfillment of what the psalmist declares in Psalm 2, I will declare the decree. Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And there is a clear and close connection between the one sitting on the throne, the contents of the book, and of course, as we will soon see, the one who is worthy to open the book, who is allowed to open the book. And that's what we enter then in verses 2, 3, and 4. Who has the right, who has the ability to open the book and to reveal the contents. So verse number 2, I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? And no man in heaven nor in earth, neither under the earth, was able to open the book, neither to look thereon. And I wept much because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon. Now certainly, folks, I think that it would go without saying that the one who is sitting on the throne is worthy. It is his book. It is in his hand. But this strong angel, and I think that the strong angel is obviously a strong angel, but right out of the gate we're being given this clue. Angels are not worthy to open the book. Not even strong angels. Not even angels like Michael or Gabriel. And he asked the question, who is worthy? Who is the one who deserves to have this? And I think that it is both a privilege and a responsibility. Who is worthy of having that kind of power? And John tells us in verse number 3, no man. And actually, what he tells us literally is no one. Nobody. Nobody is found anywhere. At any time, verse number 3, if you just look at it, no man in heaven. All right, so let's just, right, I mean, I don't want to, you know, to treat us more like we're imbeciles, but let's think through that. Who's in heaven when John writes this? Moses is in heaven. Abraham's in heaven. Adam's in heaven. David's in heaven. Elijah is in heaven. Isaiah is in heaven. Ezekiel is in heaven. Paul is in heaven. Peter is in heaven. Nobody in heaven is worthy to open the book. Of all the people who are in heaven, no one is worthy to open the book. John continues, nor in earth. Well, John's still alive. John is certainly top tier among the apostles. Peter, James, and John. John's alive. Nobody on earth is worthy. Neither under the earth. None who are dead. None who are dead. None of them are worthy either to open the book or to read it. They're not even worthy to read the contents of the book. No one has the power and no one has the worth. Now, John does not get into how he came to that realization and conclusion. He just states it as a simple fact. Nobody's worthy. No man is able. Nobody has that ability to take the book out of the right hand of the one who is holding it, who is sitting on the throne, and to open the contents of it and to see what it says. I think we know this, folks, right? John doesn't get into this. But there are no shortage of people in the world who are willing to have that kind of power. There is an abundance of people who want authority over other people, who want the ability to bring judgment and to wield judgment. There are no shortage of those people. We're everywhere. We run things. We manage things. We want to control things. Some people want to control lots of people. There's no shortage of people that are willing. But none of us are worthy. None of us are worthy. This creates great sorrow for John. Verse number 4, I wept much. I wept much. We would say he is sobbing. And I think that part of it is that John feels like he's reached some kind of an impasse. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, and I saw the Lord. And then I was in the Spirit again, and I was in heaven looking at God. And then it all comes to a screeching halt because everything stops. The one on the throne has in his right hand a book, and nobody can take the book out of his hand. Now what? Now what do we do? And where do we go? And now what happens? So I think in a very real sense, folks, with verse number 4, we have this climatic moment where John is overwhelmed with emotion. You know, I mean, John has other physical manifestations. So I'm not trying to, I mean, right, we know that he will bow and worship, and we know those kinds of things from the book of Revelation. But let's just take a minute and recover this. Right, he was in the Isle of Patmos in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, and the Lord appeared to him, and he didn't weep. And then he was transported to heaven. And he was in the Spirit, and he saw the Father, and he didn't weep. But when nobody is worthy to open the book, right, it's like the whole thing is just paused, unresolved. How long this lasts, we do not know. And then in verses 5, 6, and 7, The worthy one is announced. And one of the elders, these are the 24 elders that we saw in chapter 4, saith unto me, weep not, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the 7 seals thereof. And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the 4 beasts, and in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb as it had been slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God, sent forth into all the earth. And he came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne. So one of these 24 elders, and again, we spent some time last week talking about what they might possibly represent, which literally would be they represent nothing at all. Do they represent the completely devoted who got raptured? They don't really represent anything. They are angelic beings, or they are representative of all humanity. One of those elders said, the Lion of the tribe of Judah has prevailed. And once again, folks, if I could do this, and I know that some of you perhaps grow weary when I do these kinds of things, but I'd like to raise a minor objection to our King James translation here, because I think that they have missed an opportunity to benefit us. The word prevail is a translation of the word nikeo. It means to conquer or to succeed, to win, to defeat. My problem is not with the translation of the word nikeo into the word prevailed. My issue is that we have already read that word 7 times and it has never been translated prevailed. It's always been translated what? Overcometh. I just think that our translators missed a tremendous opportunity for us to make a mental connection with what's going on here. To him that overcometh, to the conqueror, I will give. I will grant. And here stands Jesus. Who is he? He is the conqueror. He is the overcomer. We are associated with him, and he is associated with us. Hebrews chapter 2. The way in which he prevailed and how he prevailed is not what is yet discussed. John doesn't get to that yet. What John does is identify Jesus Christ in two ways. The Lion of the tribe of Judah is the winner. We're going to come back to Revelation chapter 5, but let me ask you if you would to turn to Genesis 49. And indulge me a little poetic liberty, or a poetic license. Genesis 49, let's just begin in verse number 1. Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. It's interesting. Gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. Now this has more, folks. This has greater significance than just dad's last words. Right, this constitutes one of those Old Testament blessing type passages in which the person who is doing the blessing is speaking with some tremendously significant divine insight. Right? So Jacob is not just, right, my wife and I were just talking about this. She's been going through some pictures of the kids, trying to get them sorted and organized, you know, and you know, so we talk about the kids, and I told her for years, our youngest is just like her. No, she's not. She's just like you. No, she's just like you. And right about time Jen got married, Leafy came home one day, they were planning the wedding, she said, that girl is just like me. I said, I know. Okay? Insight into our children. That's not what's going on here, folks. This is not just a dad who knows his kids, right? There's more to this than that. All right, so Jacob gathers his 12 boys, and he's going to talk to them. Verse number 3, okay, poetic license. Reuben, you're a loser. Okay, you're a loser. There's just no other way to put it. You're just a loser. Couldn't control your lust, and you're just out. Okay, verse number 5. Simeon and Levi, you're thugs. Okay? Now remember, this is not just dad making a parental assessment. This is dad speaking very much as the voice of God. Simeon, you're a loser. I mean, Reuben, you're a loser. Simeon and Levi, you're thugs. Verse number 8, Judah. Judah, you are the one your brethren will praise. You. You're not the oldest, but you're the one your brethren will praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Reuben, Simeon, Levi. Verse number 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down. He couched as a lion, as an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? Who will dare poke the bear? Verse number 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. Now, Shiloh there is a proper name. And the translation of it roughly is, he to whom it belongs. These are instruments of royalty. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until the one who is worthy comes. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. binding his foal unto the vine and his ass's colt unto the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and clothes in the blood of grapes. This is reference to his affluence, his prosperity, right? His eyes shall be red with wine and his teeth white with milk. You are the one, Judah. You are the lion's whelp. You will be praised. You will be prosperous. You will be preeminent. This is the prediction. Who is worthy to look at the book, to loose the seals? The Lion of the tribe of Judah. This is a clear reference, folks, back to Genesis chapter 49, the Old Testament prediction of the Messiah. And then one other passage, Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse number 1. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the sucking child shall play in the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign or a banner of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, from Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. I'm going to stop there. We could continue. So to go back to Revelation chapter 5, folks, right? John takes Genesis and Isaiah and tells us who the Lamb is, or the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, hath prevailed or conquered to open the book, to overcome, and to loose the seven seals thereof. And then John tells us what he saw. Verse number 6, I looked. That's what the word beheld mean. I looked. And lo, in the midst of the throne and of the four beasts and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as it had been slain. And the word lamb there is actually a diminutive. It's a little lamb, a small lamb, standing as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. And we're glad. Aren't we not glad for that explanation of that symbolism? Or else we would, seriously, folks, would we not think it is some kind of a grotesque being? A small lamb standing as it had been slain, butchered, bloody, with seven eyes and seven horns. But those are representative of the seven spirits of God which are sent into all the earth. He has the fullness of the Spirit. Because remember, he won't judge just by what he sees or just by what he has heard. Right? That's the way we judge. Right? Those are our limitations. This is what I saw, and this is what I heard. And now we'll gather all the evidence of all that we've seen and heard, we'll make a judgment. The Lord doesn't judge that way. The Lord knows. He just knows everything in totality. Completely. What everybody was thinking, what everybody was doing, what everybody really meant, what they didn't mean, it's all there. You'll notice that the eyes are not really identified. Unless you tie them together, the seven horns and the seven eyes being represented of the seven spirits, which I would be comfortable with that, all seeing, all knowing, all powerful. Horns, from the very book of Exodus, horns are representative of power. An animal that has horns, that's where his power is. When we were in, and for some reason we saw a lot of these signs when we were on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. You'd get out of your car to walk on a trail and they'd have a sign and this kind of cartoon, not really trying to be a cartoon, but almost cartoon-like picture of a deer up on its back legs. It says, deer attack. But mostly they attack with their antlers. If they got antlers, that's what they're going to go after you with first. The strength is in the horns. All right, back to the text. Verse number 7. He came, this little lamb, as he had been slain, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne. All right, so it's very, by design, I would argue, folks, very theatrical, designed to evoke strong emotion. John is watching the one sit on the throne with a book in his hand, and an angel says, who can open the book? And nobody can. And I'm just going to assume that there is some time that passes as they wade through perhaps the possibilities. Right? If this had happened rapid fire, would John have had the opportunity to weep? That's what I wonder. Right? If the angel went, who's worthy? And the lamb walks up and goes, I'm worthy. Okay, then there's not really any reason for tears. So there's a little bit of a theatrical pageantry dimension to what we're seeing. No one is worthy, no one is able until the lamb takes the book. And he just takes the book. I mean, there's no violence there, but he just reaches over and takes the book out of the hand of the one that is holding it, which is fully emblematic of his worth to have the book. And when that happens, folks, the remainder of the chapter, verses 7 through 14, are occupied with the worship of the Lamb. Right? Chapter 4 tells us about worshiping the one on the throne, and Chapter 5 tells us about worshiping the Lamb. So verse number 8, when he had taken the book, the four beasts and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of saints. And they sung a new song, saying, thou art worthy to take the book, to open the seals thereof. For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. And hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. And I beheld and I heard the voice of many angels round about the throne and the beasts and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and such as are in the sea and all that are in them heard I saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be unto him that sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. And the four beasts said, Amen. And the 24 elders fell down and worshipped him that liveth forever and ever. So fully half of the chapter is occupied with worshiping the Lamb. No one is found worthy until the Lamb appears, and then there is universal agreement that the Lamb is the only one worthy. And so the beings and the elders that we saw in chapter 4, we see them again. Right? The beasts, right? The four beasts in verse number 8, these are the four beasts that we saw in Revelation 4:6. Four beasts full of eyes before and behind. And then there are the elders, the 24 elders, verse number 8. These are found in Revelation 4:4. Round about the throne were 24 seats, and upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment. They had on their head crowns of gold. So these four living beings, we talked about that, they're not hideous creatures, they're living creatures. And the 24 elders leave their seats, and they fall down. Right? Verse number 8, they fall down before the Lamb, and they have harps. They have golden vials full of odors, which, again, we would not have any idea what they were they not told to us that they are our prayers, that they are our prayers that have been memorialized in these jars that God keeps with our prayers in them. Again, right? The book of Revelation is given to us in signs. Does God really have a room filled with jars that are filled with prayers? And I'm not trying to be facetious, folks. I just think when we think through this, we kind of recognize intuitively that we're dealing with some symbolism. How many prayers can you put in a jar? At what point in time would the jar be filled? I mean, you know, we would border on the absurd with some of these things to try and extract them and bring them literally into our world. But these beings fall down and worship the Lamb. They have harps which are not explained. Evidently, we're going to need something to play while we're sitting on a cloud for all eternity doing nothing. And they sing this fresh song. That's, and you know, again, we could go on and on ad nauseum about what the new song is. Well, it's this song. You are worthy to take the book, to open the seals. Why? Right? We know that he's worthy on the one hand by who he is. By virtue of who he is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He is the Root of David. And now we know that he is worthy because of what he has done. Verse number 9: Thou art worthy to take the book to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain, and hast redeemed us to God. In the death that you died, you redeemed us to God by your blood. And you have, from all humanity, gathered a people. This is what is being told there. Out of every kindred. Kindred is a word that we would use to refer to tribe. And there are still many tribally oriented people in the world. Tongue refers to language. People, we would use today, we would call them a people group. Those who are not of the same tribe, but are of similar culture and similar language. And the word nation there in verse number 9 is the word that we just, it's a word we use all the time right out of the Greek. It is ethnos, ethnicity. And so from all of humanity, right? And by the way, this was this not the prediction in Genesis 49? To him shall the gathering of the Gentiles be. The Jews will worship him, your brothers, and the Gentiles will be gathered and assembled to him. And what has happened is that all of these people, this multitude of people, are being constituted into one new ethnicity of people, the people of God. And our King James tells us in verse number 10, thou hast made us unto our gods kings and priests. There's nothing at all wrong with the translation there. Just think of it this way, folks. I don't think that what John is arguing is that some of us will be kings and others of us will be priests. But this is taking us back most likely to Exodus chapter 19 and verse number 6, when God was informing the Israelites of the nature of the Mosaic covenant and what it would mean. Exodus 19:6, ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And what is going to happen, folks, to that nation of people that are constituted God's people? Well, Revelation 5:10 tells us what's going to happen to us. Right? This is part of the reason that we dig our heels in for a literal millennial kingdom. And we shall reign on the earth. We shall reign on the earth. Look, folks. Now, you could have another view besides a premillennial, pre-tribulational view and argue for that. So I'm not going to get into that fight. I'm just simply going to get into this fight. To deny that in some way and at some point in time, there is a reign of God on earth and his people are a part of it, is to deny the plain teaching of the text. And God is not given, folks, to making vague, ambivalent predictions. In fact, he is very critical of people who make those kind of predictions, right? What is the criteria of prophet? It has to come to pass. A prediction has to come to pass. So we need to tread lightly about going, yeah, that's what it says, but that's not really what it means. We're going to reign on the earth. The Lamb is constituting a people that will be to him a kingdom of priests. They will be a holy nation, a peculiar people, Peter tells us, and we will reign with him on the earth. But then in verses 11 through 13, right, our view is expanded. Our worship is expanded. And I beheld and I heard the voice of many angels round about the throne. And then I'm going to skip over because what he's saying there, I heard the voice of many angels that were round about the throne, and what was there were the beasts and the elders, right? Because the four living beasts and the 24 elders, we already know about them. Now we're going to know about this. I hear these voices. And the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. How many angels are there? Millions of them. There are millions of angels. That's what John says. And these millions of angels, verse number 12, they chime in now, worthy is the Lamb that was slain. So that the entirety of heaven, so to speak, is proclaiming the worthiness of the Lamb. He is worthy to receive power. And I think that it's written that way because that's what's happening when he takes the book. Right? that book is a powerful book. When he receives the power that is in that book and begins to loosen the seals, folks, it is an awesome thing to behold on planet Earth. He is worthy to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. That pretty much covers all that we could give him, and he is worthy of all of it. Now again, verse number 12 is quoting the angels. These millions of angels, 10,000 times 10,000, thousands of thousands. And so ultimately then, this great crescendo, every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and such as are in the sea and all that are in them, heard I say, blessing and honor and glory and power be unto him that sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. And now we come back full circle to the two groups that we've known from chapter 4. The four beasts said amen, and the 24 elders fell down and worshipped him that liveth forever and ever. So the Lamb, where we go next week, well, actually, we won't go there next week. Well, let me just make a couple of concluding points. What we have, folks, in Revelation 4 and 5 is a view of world and world power and wielding of that power that is radically different from anything we see on earth. The only one worthy to rule is a little lamb who has been slain. And the little lamb in his sacrificial death gives to us the right to rule and reign with him. Something we don't often think about, folks, when we talk about grace is the high price God paid to be gracious to us. It is wonderful free grace to us, but it costs God the blood of his Son Christ. We want to remember as we live as Christians, folks, that we are living a life not directed towards victory, but out of victory. The victory, in a very real sense, has already been won. We are not working towards it and hoping for it. We are living out in light of that victory. And the trajectory that God has for his people, because it is the one that he has for his Son, is that before you become a lion, you are a lamb. Humiliation before glorification. And finally, folks, the last thing we want to remember is that real power originates in heaven, not on earth. In our world, and we who are politically conservative are watching in some measure of disbelief as we see this being played out by a politically liberal administration. In our world, powerful people are seldom good, and good people are seldom powerful. But in the kingdom that is coming, he who is only good will also be only powerful. That is the way the world will work. All right, if you want to grab your prayer bulletin,